So I understand you're going out today to look at edible plants, is that true? Oh, you were just finding out? Sorry. So I have a story for you. Well, it's not that interesting. But there were these two brothers, and they set out from their father's house to make their way in the world. And they were walking along, and they came to an anthill. And one brother said, "Well, let's tear down that anthill." And the other brother said, "No, it probably took the ants a long time to build the anthill, so let's not." So they didn't, and they went on. And they came to a beautiful lake. And on the lake, there were some ducks swimming. And the brother said, "Oh, let's shoot the ducks and eat them." And the other brother said, "No, they look so serene and peaceful gliding on the lake. Let's just pass by." So they did. And then the next thing they did was see a tree with a beehive, bees flying around it, and there was so much honey coming out of it that the first brother said, "Let's chop down that tree and get all the honey." And the other brother said, "No, the bees have worked so hard to make all that honey. Let's not do that." So you can see that these brothers were very different. They were incompatible traveling companions, actually. But they went along until they came to a castle. There were castles all over the place in those days. And so they went into the castle hoping to find something to eat. And what they found was a little old man who didn't say anything but directed them toward a book. And this big book lay open, and they went to read it, and it said, "This castle is under a spell. No one can speak. But whoever breaks the spell will have the reward of going to the zoo and letting all the animals out and petting them." So the brothers decided they would try to do the instructions. There were three instructions in the book, and the first one was to gather all the leftover food that had been left in the forest by picnickers. So they went out to look for all this, for as much food as they could find that had been left behind. You know how when you're eating on a blanket, you know, and you're eating a sandwich and some of it falls down. You're familiar with that, right? So, yes, you've been there, right? So they gathered as much as they could, and it wasn't very much because, you know, it takes, you have to have your nose practically on the ground. That was my chin hitting the mic. You have to have your nose practically on the ground before you can see bits of food. So the first brother went all around. They couldn't gather a thing, but the ants came to the second brother and said, "We'll gather up all the bits of food that have fallen." So he had a nice little pile to put in his backpack at the end of a few hours. So he took it back and laid it on the table where the book was. The second instruction was to get a key. And the key, it said, was at the bottom of the lake. So the brothers went out, and they went to the lake. And it turned out when they waded in, the lake was pretty deep. You couldn't hold your breath long enough to get to the bottom of the lake. But then the ducks came over and said, "We'll get the key." They dove down. What am I doing? Maybe that'll help. So the ducks dove down and got the key. So they came and, or the second brother brought the key and put it on the table. The third instruction was to take the key and open the door where there were three sleeping princesses. Princesses were all over the place then, too. He took the key, he opened the door. Oh, and the instruction said to take the hand of the youngest princess, and she would awake, and the spell would be broken. So he went in. There were three princesses, and he didn't know which was the younger. How could he tell? They didn't have their birthday anywhere in the room. But just then a bee flew in the window, and it landed on the lips of one of the princesses. And so he took her hand, she awoke, and the spell was broken. And so the younger brother got to go to the zoo and release all the animals, and they all came to be petted in turn because they saw that he was a friend. You enjoyed that, huh? So my question to you is, which brother do you think you would have been? Anybody willing to say? You would have been the youngest? Good, good. Yeah? What's your name, the first boy who spoke?
Uh-huh.
Tsunami? And your name? Eli. Any other comments? Do you think this happens a lot, that people are asked to do things that they aren't sure that they know how to do at first? Does it ever happen to you? Are you ever asked to do something you don't know how to do? Something like what? But you know how to do that, right? What's your name?
Hannah.
Hannah. Good. That was the first chore when I lived at Green Gulch with my son. That was the first chore he was given, is to feed our dog. And we had one dog. You have two? What kind? Oh, good, good friendly dog. Anybody else? Anybody else willing to say which brother they would have been? Yes. What's your name? Elizabeth? Lucy. You could be a sister too. This could be two sisters just as easily. The smallest one. Because you like animals? Any other comments? Anyone over here? Yes? What's your name? Lillian. There's an independent-minded young lady. Can't kill ducks. Okay. Words to live by. Thank you very much for coming. I know it was hard to sit still for so long. Have a good day. Bye-bye. I know I did.
did a play of that same story.
You did a play of it? What was the name of the play?
I forget it, but it was the same story.
Did you have a part in the play?
We did it like every day. One time I was a duck to go down to get a key.
You were the duck. Oh, it's a dove to get the key. Great. You two look like brothers. Oh, here's the older brother and the younger brother. Well, I'm sure you're both younger brothers. Bye-bye. Bye, Lillian. Bye, Eli.
Anyone would like to come forward?
Hi, good to see you. Thank you. You're welcome. Christina, hi. Would anyone else like to move down in front? I don't heckle. This is supposed to end at 11. Okay. Thank you. Good morning. Well, I've had quite a summer. The people around me have had quite a summer. Mucho suffering. The main features of the summer for me, a very dear friend died up in Spokane, and before she died, she asked me to come do her memorial, and which was challenging because she's a strident atheist, but a very kind and generous person. She was a doctor who traveled all around the world for Doctors Without Borders. She went all over the world dispensing medical care to people who'd never had medical care. And she was very sorry to die in her early 50s because she wanted to continue to do that work. And she had been to Tassajara, but it wasn't really her thing. She came to do a workshop with me a couple years ago, but was put off by the forms and rituals, as many people are, who are rejecting a very strict childhood or whatever. It doesn't matter. Anyway, she was a deeply loving person, and I feel a spiritual person, and I was quite honored when she asked me, would I do her funeral after she died, and her husband felt the same way as she. So I changed all the Buddhas to compassionate ones, and then just pretty much let my own heart flow in designing this funeral. And I went up about a week after she died, and it was really important to move the grief through everybody and myself. But the morning that she died and I received the phone call, another woman in a sangha that I have up in Healdsburg came and told me that her lover of 20 years had left her for someone younger, 30 years younger. And I was already vulnerable, and her telling me that and her obvious, you know, first blush suffering really affected me. And so over the next week or so, in which I actually I couldn't uh, couldn't see other people who were suffering. That rarely happens to me, that I can't absorb kind of more or less endlessly. Not really, but the amount of suffering that I'm presented with by people I know is limited in a way that I can absorb most of what's presented. But I was down for the count. The woman whose lover left her was so racked. Her whole life was built around that person. So the reason I'm telling you this is because it's relevant to what happened to me as I started thinking about what was the most important things to me, because I was just awash in the suffering that was going on. So I just thought about how closely can loss and pain etch into me. What is so important to me in my own life? And so it's those experiences reaffirmed for me what is most important to me in this life. One is awareness of my body as a point of view. I'm in this body looking out. Not to go too far from that, from this flesh with all its delusions and desires. Not to get too far away from that. And secondly, another very important thing to me, and I've built my whole life as a teacher around it, is body-to-body intimacy. Bodies in the same room together like this, bodies sitting together, bodies eating together, bodies touching each other, bodies walking side by side. That's very important to me, and maybe it's all I teach. And the last thing that's very important to me, and it's on the edge of practice all the time for me, it's really my challenge in practice, is appreciation of what is and settling into what is. Just this right here, whatever it is, settling into it. So I came into the kind of awareness that I'm talking about, awareness of my body as a point of view and of the importance of body-to-body intimacy, as a much younger woman. At age 35, while living here at Green Gulch, I was gradually crippled over a period of about 6 months by a relentless, painful disease which was eventually diagnosed as rheumatoid arthritis. So I ended up not being able to walk without help, even to the bathroom, and I was too weak to even lift an old-fashioned phone receiver. And I had a 3-year-old child, Ethan Patchell, who was born here. I was estranged from his father. He had moved out of Green Gulch because he no longer wanted to practice here. And I had no health insurance, and my teacher at the time was very distracted by life outside Green Gulch. At the time, I had been practicing for 7 years. So various people at Zen Center moved me to San Francisco. I couldn't negotiate the distances here between things. Took care of my son. David Chadwick took him to Texas for 6 weeks. And signed up, a sign-up schedule of care for me was put on the city center desk, and people signed up to wash my hair, change my sheets, walk my dog. So although I eventually came to be tremendously grateful for the care I received at the time, it kept me out of a rehabilitation hospital. At the time, I was just humiliated that I needed it. Just humiliated. And not only was I humiliated, I was devastated, terrified, desperate, in a panic, completely unable to deal with this level of loss. And I had just spent 7 years on a cushion at the city center, Tassajara, and here at Green Gulch. So it isn't that I spent the first 7 years of my sitting practice just head tripping on a cushion. Actually, I did. But fortunately for me, there was something else going on at the same time. And I just didn't know it right away. I just couldn't feel it right away. And what gradually became apparent over the next year that I spent in the bed of an apartment in San Francisco, what had been happening during all those years of sitting, which was too subtle for me to notice at the time, actually, since I was quite distracted by pain. But also, while it was happening, the 7 years of practice, I was also distracted by social interactions here at Green Gulch, mostly, and by my ambition at Zen Center to become a powerful person at Zen Center. So, of course, I didn't notice subtle things like my relationship to my body. But what was happening is that I was learning during that time something about settling into my body, this body. And very soon into my illness, I began to realize that I had learned something about that. Because my only relationship to my body before I was ill was how good it looked in a mirror, or how bad it looked mostly. I was very critical. Now when I look at pictures of myself at the time, I was gorgeous. So, but I didn't see it then. I didn't see anything but critical. Too fat over here, too short over here, too whatever. That's the relationship I had with my body. And then when I started sitting, I thought, now why won't this body just sit cross-legged and not bother me? Why won't it just do what it's told? So that had been my relationship to my body. So imagine now, here I am lying in bed, and other things became obvious. Whether this is the body that you want and admire, it doesn't matter. This particular body is the only one that you have to experience your life with, to connect with other bodies, to actually feel and experience the full comfort of mundane objects, to experience mundane objects. All the days of your life, this is it, this body, whether you like it or not, it's the only way you have of relating to anything. So it turned out that my body was settled in some basic way. It had been, unbeknownst to me, with all my attention focused away from it, it had been developing the kind of stability that allows us, that enables us, to absorb enormous amounts of suffering and process enormous amounts of suffering, ours and other people's. It was cultivating the silence which enables us to reach our deepest yearnings. So when I finally recovered sufficiently to have a functional body again, and I began actually to work with and help people who were in similar circumstances, catastrophic circumstances, I had a choice then whether to go back to the way I had been before, asking my body to do what I wanted it to do, body of slave mentality. And I chose not to go back, but to stay with the body that I have, though it's very limited. Of course, as I get older, the difference between me and other people is less apparent. People are catching up. So, and whenever I hear people complain about aging, I'm not very compassionate that way. So I decided to stay in my body and retain its point of view, not to abandon it. And that's when, returning to sitting again after several years away, just doing my little meditation on movement type things, I developed a meditative movement. I'm not the first, I'm sure, but I developed meditative movement that I could do in place of zazen, because sitting still was so difficult and painful. So when I came back into sesshins with other people, oh, I so loved the body-to-body intimacy. I felt the support of other bodies, the implicit support that somebody is right there digesting away right next to you, or breathing away. You know, they're right there with you. Well, you know how it is from sesshins. If the person next to you, who maybe you've never seen before, doesn't come one period, you, oh my God, what happened to them? Did they quit? Are they sick? Or, you know, you worry about them. We're very close to each other, especially during when we're quiet. But it still goes on whether we're quiet or not. So I've never forgotten how important that is in my life. In fact, as I said, it is maybe the only thing that I teach, getting bodies together to cook, to walk, things like that. So I have occasionally been distracted from my body by the intense suffering of people that I love, or by weariness or grief. But basically, essentially, I always settle back on just this body, just this appreciation of it, just this suffering. This particular suffering. So this awareness continued for me in July. I went down to Tassajara to do my workshop down there with a good friend, Daya Goldschlag. We've had body-to-body intimacy since we met at Tassajara 35 years ago. She actually walked me up a tour in England, you know, to see King Arthur and Queen Guinevere's grave, you know. Whatever. So we tied my leg onto her leg, my right leg onto her left leg, and she walked me up the hill. So that's how we got up there. So we've had this close body-to-body relationship for a long time. We say our friendship is in our bodies. You know, our personalities aren't particularly compatible. We both like to course in the realm of the gods, but that's about it. But our bodies just know each other so well. So I went to Tassajara to do this workshop called The One Who Is Not Busy. And I was on the verge of canceling it, actually, because there were only 6 people. And Di and I have always had like 20, 25 people, but only 6 people came to this. Until I met the people. Powerhouses, you know, entrepreneurs, corporate, a manager, or I guess you would call it a director in a nonprofit. I mean, really interesting people. And they were all interested in practice. And they went to the student sittings as well as the guest sitting that we had at a more convenient time. We had our sitting about 8:15, and as you know, the student sittings are way early. They went to those, and they went to the evening ones as well. Every minute with this group of people was lively and challenging. So the reason I'm talking about them is, again, I was reminded of these basic things, because basically their problem was how to be busy and conscientious in their work. They were all responsible for other people and the business itself, but also relaxed and sensitive to others. And then how to do their work. They all thought it was important to do their work in a way that was wider than just the work itself, wider than just self-interest and profit. How to do the work in a way that was considerate, globally accountable, you know, spiritually accountable, some wider point of view than just the business. And then how not to fall into distraction and being driven. You know, it's so easy. It's so easy to just chuck all your values out and just go, go, go. Because in today's work world, if you're not absolutely clear that you don't want to do that, enough to make your values a very stout pole in a rushing river, you'll just be swept up by our cultural values right now. The default position, if you don't assert your own values, are acquisition and speed. You'll just be swept up in that unless you have your own stout pole. So I think it boils down to two things. What is the most important thing to you? What is your life about really? In other words, what is your samadhi? What is the thing that you focus on all through your walking around life? Picking up the dry cleaning, making a deposit at the bank, stopping at a stoplight, doing the projects at your work. What is it that you're thinking about while you're doing all these things? That's a samadhi. I'm stretching the word a little, but that is a walking around samadhi. The object of focus. What are you focused on? And you'd better figure it out. That's one thing. And then the other is, how do we deal out in the world, how do we deal with suffering, other people's and our own suffering? So can we settle into it at all? Can we settle? Or must we numb it over or distract ourselves? I think those are the main choices. So how you answer that question for yourself is very important. So, if I were working in the world, actually I try, but I never get very far. I'm always distracted by sitting. Well, that's not strictly true, but if I were in the world, I would definitely look around for stuff in my life already that helped me in this process, that helped me settle into suffering and did not encourage me to numb over or distract myself. So as I say, I think that being clear about your priorities is very important. So what is it you focus on? Your fear, security, greed, service to others, love, dana paramita. I think it's possible to focus on the flow of goods, meaning the flow of nourishment, any kind of nourishment, including love. I think that's a very good focus, actually. How it comes into you and how you offer it out. So I think it's also important to convince yourself or to bring yourself into experience with the still, quiet mind. Because I think that that's the mind that knows your deepest desires. And you can be very distracted by acquisition if you don't know what you really want. Then you keep trying to fill this hole with shiny objects. So you have to be clear about what part of yourself you're going to operate on. And I think it's only the still, quiet mind that brings you to a place that you can trust, that brings you to a part of yourself that's trustworthy. Almost all parts of ourselves are not trustworthy. Just sit and watch your mind, you'll know. But there's some part, and maybe it actually sends tendrils into all the other parts so that all the parts become trustworthy in a way, even your greed or your aversion. But there must be some contact with the part that you can trust. And then finally, the willingness over the course of your life and your practice to shift as the basis of reality from appetite to breath. To shift from I want this, I don't want that, to just breathing. To just breathing. A willingness to have and cultivate a breath-based reality. From what I want to what's going on now. What's going on now? So people ask me what to do when pain, when their pain gets so intense that it actually interferes with their agenda of greed, hate, and delusion. That's when we notice it. It can't be ignored anymore when you get there. So we have to stop whatever our pain is, mental anguish or physical pain, that actually stops us from being driven and compulsive. We have to stop and deal with our suffering when the pain gets too intense, whatever that pain is. And I always advise people when they ask me to turn toward their suffering, which is so hard that it actually requires training and specific skill. It's so hard to do this. And when you sit, you are training in these specific skills. So why would you turn towards suffering? I'm going to make a case now in the 5 minutes I have left. The first reason to turn toward your suffering, to actually settle into it and feel it as opposed to numb it out or go get drunk or see a movie or have a love affair. I mean, all that's fine, but not as a distraction. It should be the main suffering. So, the first reason to turn towards suffering is because suffering is not what it looks like on the outside. If you're not actually in suffering, it's different than what you imagine. The projection is completely different from what it actually is. So people tell me all the time, oh, if I were you, I'd commit suicide. You know, I couldn't possibly deal with pain as you, brave and resolute, have. Listen, I cried and screamed and begged God through most of my illness. I am not brave, but I was willing to be in my suffering. I am willing to be in my suffering now. It's completely different than what you would imagine it to be. Because if it's your life, of course it opens up. It opens up into picking up the spoon and putting food into your mouth and pressing the microwave buttons and getting yourself to the physical therapist. It just opens up into your life. So to turn toward it and settle into it is not the same as being chased around by the specter of what's going to happen to you if you don't cure this. And secondly, if you acknowledge your suffering, you get off the attainment track and learn how to enter your actual experience. And in your actual experience, if you live from the point of view of your breath, suffering has a proper place in your life. It has a proper place. You wouldn't know anything about joy if you didn't have suffering. I mean, just for starters. But through acknowledging your pain to settling, then you're not on the hungry ghost, the when is this going to end track. Some people say to me when they start sitting, the people in pain whom I talk to, they say, well, I started my meditation practice like you said, but the pain hasn't gone away yet. So of course I don't tell them that it never will. That's not good to tell people that. They should find out on their own. So sometimes people stop sitting because the pain doesn't go away. So this is the attainment track, the hungry ghost track, the doing something to get something. If you do something to get something, if you prepare a meal to eat it and don't pay any attention to the prep, then how are you going to pay attention to the meal? You know, it is a muscle. It is a muscle to be worked out, your attention muscle, your focus muscle. So it's important. And meditation practice helps us forego our preferences and settle into just this. So if you do zazen, specifically the practice of observing whatever comes to your mind and goes without inviting it in or pushing it away, you see how the mind works. Things come and they go, they come, they stay for 40 minutes, and then you get up and they go away. Or things come and you want them to stay, like a calmness or peace, but they go right away. So you just watch how it works, watch all the interplay in your mind. And I think that being able to watch that and then getting up and walking around, you're walking around life, if you can look at things that way, that kind of basic way that you do in zazen, it makes it much easier to settle as well as have preferences. If you're only on the preference track, you're doomed, because there's no place you can be that you wouldn't rather be somewhere else. Someone at Tassajara said to me, "This is the most gorgeous place I've ever been. This is terrific. Now if I just had a bunch of lovers here with me." If you live in preference, there's no time you're ever going to settle down. So it's good to kind of expand your consciousness beyond preference, so that preference can be just one of the tracks. And right view, watching things arise and fall, is one way, just watching phenomena come and go. Also, direct meditation helps us settle into our direct, unmediated by concept experience. This is breath reality. So if I right now go out of my words and I start looking at you all from the point of view of breath, you start moving. You start not being the same every time my eyes settle on you. Slightly different expression, and say, I start tuning into the details, and you're not different from the wall. You know, that's just as interesting, the shadow play on the wall, as your expression. So breath is this right here. When I come back into my words, I prefer the expressions on your face 1,000 times over the wall. So I think also that meditation practice helps us develop patience. And I read a wonderful article by a man who had developed MS, and gradually, as with the case with MS, he gradually lost function over time. You know, over a period of years, you can lose a lot of mobility. And he talked about being helped by his young son into the park, and there was a deep sandy a dune. I guess they were on the beach. There was actually a dune. It was big. And there was a turtle there at the bottom of the pit. And somebody, some person, who thinking they were kind, had taken her eggs and put them on level ground. So she was very patiently moving her eggs back into the pit. But it took her forever to climb up the walls of the dune. She would take a step and slip back, take a step and slip back. And then she'd get about halfway there, and the sand would be a little drier, and she'd slip all the way back. And every time she did that, she would start again. didn't lay at the bottom of the pit. She just kept, each time, climbing and climbing. And isn't that our life, really? So this man, Philip Simmons by name, he watched this. This was early on in his incapacitation with MS. And he watched her and he said, "This will be my spirit. This is my totem, the turtle. This is my totem. Takes me a long time to get dressed in the morning. Takes me a long time to get to the kitchen, a long time to make tea. But I'll just keep doing it because my pace is my own." And this is one way that I very much appreciate my body's point of view. My body is a slower body than most, although when Thich Nhat Hanh came to visit Zen Center in the city, he said, "Could I walk with you? Because you're the only one who walks as slowly as I do." So, cool. This way of just going about your life from your own pace, from your own pace. You can speed up that pace when there's a project at work that you're responsible for doing. That's still your own pace. And then lastly, now that Ram Dass has made a movie about his life after he had a stroke, I'm sure most people are familiar with what he's had to say, but I remember reading his first interview years ago after his stroke. And at first he couldn't talk at all, which is torture to him, I'm sure. Or I would be tortured, again, projecting how I would feel. But he said everything.